speaker already pointed out. So I've used the same strategy, which is to try and list the main points in advance. So I don't see the pointer, but I can use this, I guess. Yeah. List the main points in advance, so at least they don't get lost. These are kind of in the form of a good news, bad news sequence. The first point, the good news, is that discreteness can respect Lorentz transformations. This has been somewhat controversial, and you may be aware of claims that that's not the case, and one should look for effects like modified dispersion relations. But I claim that, in fact, it can respect Lorentz transformations. And when I say Lorentz transformations, I don't mean, interesting as they may be, I don't mean some modified or deformed or Hopf algebra type of transformations, but just the same Lorentz transformations you find in any textbook of special relativity. We'll see that kinematic randomness plays a certain role, specifically a Poisson process in this. The corresponding bad news, then, if at least it's bad news if you're a fan of locality, is that locality must be abandoned. You can put together discreteness and Lorentz invariance, but at the cost of locality. In fact, you get a radical non-locality at the fundamental level, at what I'll call the microscopic scale L. However, there's good news. In fact, if this good news weren't there, we could forget about the whole approach. One can recover locality, at least approximately at large scales, at what you might call the macroscopic scale. However, it's not that simple. There's a strong indication, and I'll say specifically what that indication is, that a residual non-locality will survive at much larger scales than you would have expected, not only at the Planckian scale, but at some intermediate length scale, which I'll call here lambda naught. If that's true, then any effective theory that would be valid at this intermediate scale, would be a continuum theory, but it would be non-local. So it may be that one of the evidences of the underlying discreteness that comes out of quantum gravity would be some effective non-locality that's occurring at a much larger length scale that might be one of the first things you could pick up as a signal of quantum gravity. So these are the main points, and stated abstractly, I'd like to illustrate them with a particular theory, the scalar field on a background causal set C. So the discrete structure, of course, will be a causal set. And the specific question in relation to which I'd like to try to illustrate this is the recovery of the D'Alembertian for the scalar field. In other words, can we find some expression on the causal set that in some appropriate coarse graining goes over to the scalar field, to the D'Alembertian, from which the equation of motion of the scalar field could be derived classically, and hopefully a quantum field theory version as well. Just in passing, let me mention that there's another kind of non-locality, a residual non-locality of quantum origin that has to do with the discreteness of space-time that comes out of quantum causal set theory, which is related to fluctuations in the cosmological constants. That, I think, is important and was a prediction of that in a, arguably has been confirmed by recent observations, but that's not the non-locality I'm going to talk about today. So let's go back to the first point now, which was that discreteness and Lorentz invariance are compatible. Why is that the case? And what role does randomness play? Well, if you imagine a cubic lattice or something like that in space-time, it's very easy to see that after you boost it, it looks nothing like a cubic lattice. On the other hand, if you start with a random lattice, as you might say, a random sprinkling of points in space-time, then the claim is that after a boost, it looks essentially no different than what it did before the boost. So here I've drawn such a causal set. Actually, I haven't made by sprinkling two-dimensional Minkowski space. I haven't actually drawn in the causal relations. They're implied by the light cone structure, the usual 45-degree lines. You have to imagine those. But here's the causal set anyway. Here's a small portion of it, which is blown up so you can see the individual points more clearly. Now we carry out a large boost. We get this picture here. We take the region that corresponds to that same region, another square region, that it's now down here, blow it up, and take a look at it here. You can see that although in fine detail it's not the same, it's substantially indistinguishable from the first diagram. So that's a sort of practical illustration of how randomness makes possible a Lorentz invariant discretization. However, it's just a picture that it may convince you if you're prone to be convinced, or if you were skeptical, it may convince you. You shouldn't have been so skeptical. However, we can do better than a picture. And I mention this because of the controversy that has been surrounding some of these claims. So the actual theorem, which tells this in a very precise way, so let me just run through the theorem, although I won't give its proof, although the proof is not very long. You can find it on GRQC. So this is in now in any dimension, Minkowski space of any dimension. Consider the space of all sprinklings, by which I just mean countable subsets, discrete countable subsets of the space-time. So the result of throwing in at random a countable number of points at unit density. So, well, countable number of points. The fact that it's unit density comes in the measure. So that's specifically you can what's called the Poisson process, the generalization of the one-dimensional Poisson process, can be defined in higher dimensions. It produces mathematically a measure mu on the space of all sprinklings, the sample space. Now, what we're trying to prove is that you cannot derive from a sprinkling a distinguished frame. That's how we'll interpret not breaking Lorentz invariance. If it broke Lorentz invariance, then looking at the sprinkling, you would say, OK, it corresponds to this frame, not that frame. If not a whole frame, you should at least be able to get a state of rest, a unit vector in Minkowski space. If it were possible to do that, there would have to be a function, f, a rule that would allow you to do the deduction. So it would be a map from the space of all sprinklings to the space of unit vectors, which I've called here h. Now, of course, there is such a rule. It's easy to think of it. You give me a sprinkling. I throw the sprinkling away, and I always point in that direction. That's a rule, a function from sprinklings to directions. It's obviously a cheat. The way to see it, it's a cheat, is that if I take the sprinkling and boost it, the direction that I've given you doesn't get correspondingly boosted. So to exclude such cheats, we want to require equivariance, that the rule commutes with the Lorentz transformations. Also, we need a small technical, very weak technical assumption, which is that f should be measurable. Then one can prove that no such f exists. Not even partially, that is, it's not even the case that maybe, well, some sprinklings don't allow you to define a frame and some do. The statement is none of them can, or at least no set of non-zero measure can do it. So to put it in other words, with probability one, if you carry out a sprinkling by this Poisson process in Minkowski space, you'll get something that's in itself Lorentz invariant. So the consequence of that is actually that in causal set theory, not only you can achieve Lorentz invariance, but you're forced to it in some sense because of the kinematic rules which make the Poisson process central. So we have Lorentz invariance. Now, the bad news was supposed to be that we lose locality. So why do I say we lose locality? So the consequence of that is, in particular, that something like a box operator, a D'Alembertian, is extremely difficult to define because, of course, it is effectively a local operator. Well, it is in the continuum a local operator. So here I've tried to illustrate what you would have to do to define the D'Alembertian of a scalar field. So I haven't drawn the scalar field, but I've drawn this dotted circle. I don't know how well the colors come out here, but I've drawn this dotted circle. That represents a region in which there are a few wavelengths of the scalar field, which we can imagine as slowly varying in this frame. If you were to try to define it by a finite difference kind of expression on a normal lattice, you would just take nearest neighbors and form some differences and linear combination. That would approximate the derivatives and give you the D'Alembertian. Here, the nearest analog of nearest neighbor are these causal links, causal nearest neighbors, or parent-child relations, as you might call them. These two red ones, for example, would be good ones. They sample the field at nearby points, and from them you might hope to just construct the D'Alembertian. However, these aren't all the causal links. Just because of the Lorentz invariant, any boost of this is also a causal link. So the causal links are all spread out along the light cone here, this is meant to be the light cone, of course. In particular, you have this kind of causal link like this green one, which in this frame is very far into the past and very far away, and it samples the field at a point that has nothing to do with the local derivative. So basically, we have to throw them out. But it's not that simple. We can't throw them out, because then when we want to apply the same expression to a boosted field, where the relevant region would now look like this long ellipse, then this long link, this red one now, is the good one, and these green ones become no good. So we need some kind of miracle. We need an expression which somehow, as it were, looks at the field, says, OK, which links do I want to use for you, uses those, and throws all the others away. That seems almost impossible. And it seems even more impossible if you consider a field that's itself invariant under Lorentz transformations, like t squared minus x squared. You could easily convince yourself that the answer can only be infinity or zero in that case. And I did sort of convince myself that for a long time. But it seems that there is actually a miracle that's possible. And to illustrate, I'll give you the exact formula in a bit, but to illustrate the thinking behind it or the motivation, consider this two-dimensional example here. If we were to take, this is meant to be square, it looks a little distorted, but if we were to take this diamond of points, and if it really were drawn the way it's supposed to be, then a standard discrete or finite difference approximation to the D'Alembertian, in this case, it's the Lorentzian analog of the Laplacian, is to take the sum of A and C, the field values there, minus the sum at B and D. So the two, this diagonal pair minus this diagonal pair, that will converge, if you make this a very small square, to the D'Alembertian. So that's good. But then we have also the analogs of this green one here, which is no good. The analog here of this diamond would be a very long stretched out diamond like this. However, this is what we don't want to contribute. But now you see there's a reason why it might not. If you reorganize this sum, A plus C minus B plus D, it's also A minus D minus B minus C. But A minus D is just this little stretch here, and B minus C, this little interval here. There you're dealing with things that are very close together, so the difference is going to be nearly zero. So there's some hope. Now, in an actual sprinkling, we won't get points exactly on the light cone. That's probability zero. But this is just really serves as motivation for playing around and trying to get something that realizes the same ideas, that works in the context of Poisson process of invariant sprinkling. And I'll just tell you one of the possible answers. There are more than one, but here's one possible one, the simplest one, that works in 1 + 1 dimension. So what does it say? We're trying to find an expression for the D'Alembertian of the scalar field at this point O, this sprinkled point that I've called O. You take all the past nearest neighbors. I'm trying to produce actually a retarded expression here. So you take the past nearest neighbors, what I called layer one here. You take the value of the field at all of those, add them up. These are the parents, as you might say. Then you take the value of the field at what you might call the grandparents, those that are two removes down from O, double it, subtract off, and then take those at three removes, add it back in. So you have binomial coefficients here, 1 minus 2, 1. Take that combination, subtract off half the value of the field at the point 0, and you get, with a certain scaling, you get an expression, which I've written here as box phi in the discrete sense, which can be regarded as a matrix acting on the vector of field values. I've written out here the matrix in another form. I'll just skip it for shortage of time. The important point is that you can now prove that in the limit in which the sprinkling becomes finer and finer, the limit in which the Planck length goes to zero, if you want, that this expression, well, I want to say that I would like it to be that it converges to the D'Alembertian, but it's really a probabilistic expression. It depended on the sprinkling. So I do different sprinklings, I get different numbers. So I have a probability distribution. But I can evaluate its mean, and I get, in the limit, it does go to the D'Alembertian. you can evaluate its mean using some facts about the Poisson distribution. This here, this exponential here, for example, is the probability of the point sprinkled at UV being a nearest neighbor to O, if there is a point sprinkled at UV. So all of that is good. The problem is that the fluctuations don't go to zero, they go to infinity. So here comes the second key step, is we can actually overcome that. We look at that averaged expression that I gave before that represented the average of all sprinklings. It's actually a purely continuum expression because you've averaged out over the sprinklings. It's just the result of applying some integral kernel to the field phi. And here I've written the kernel out explicitly. In the integral kernel, there's a length scale. That length scale, before it was just a length scale set by the causal set, 1 over the Planck length squared. However, we can don't have to keep it like that. We can decouple it from that, hold it fixed when we send the Planck length to 0 or make it very small. Holding it fixed gives just a continuum, non-local analog of the D'Alembertian. So we've lost all reference to discreteness temporarily. We can now turn around and approximate. So we started with a discrete expression. To take the mean, we got an integral expression. We can now decouple the length scale in that from the Planck length, turn around and discretize that continuum expression to get back to the discrete. That produces an expression here, which looks rather like the earlier one. It involves the field at the point O, which I called here Y. But now it's a sum not only of the nearest neighbors and next nearest neighbors, but over all the elements x to the past of y. And the weighting factor is a little more complicated. It's a polynomial times an exponential, where the polynomial either was written down. It wasn't written down. It's a simple second-degree polynomial. I'll give you the four-dimensional form in a second. So this trick drives down the fluctuations, but at a cost. The cost is that non-locality has now survived not just on the Planck scale, but at the intermediate scale lambda naught, which is so far for us to choose. If we again go back to the continuum expression, of course, it's just this continuum one that we started with when we took the discretization. This was a reference, this Umkehren, you can forget about for now, that was a reference to some supposedly famous saying about of a mathematician that man, in German, that man muss immer umkehren, which is what we did there. So now we have two box operators to play with, a discrete one, which is usable at the microscopic level, and a continuous one usable in ordinary Minkowski space, for example. So what can we do with them? And so this is the last transparency, opacity. So the first thing that I should mention, everything that I showed you before, the specific formulas are all in 1 plus 1 dimension. There are analogs for this in any other dimension, and here specifically is the four-dimensional one. It has the same general form. The polynomial is different, which you can't see because I neglected to give the polynomial before. But it's it corresponds to, we started, remember, in the discrete setting with the nearest neighbors, next nearest neighbors. We had binomial coefficients. Here we have a similar setup, only you go one more layer down and you have binomial coefficients based on 3 rather than on 2. And the corresponding polynomial that you get when you take the mean is this particular polynomial where C can be viewed as the volume between the two points at which you're trying to evaluate this current integral kernel. So having this discrete expression, we can now study propagation, for example, of a scalar field on a causal set to see possible effects of discreteness. Many people have just speculated that interesting phenomenology from quantum gravity can come from the discreteness. Often the speculation went in the direction of modified dispersion relations. That we won't have here because Lorentz invariance is built in, but there are many other things that can happen that are interesting and that we may be able, you can now explicitly study with this model of propagation on a causal set. A short comment I should make is that one may, in fact, if Ted Jacobson were here, he would ask me, what about the stability? Because he did ask me about the stability. And in the continuum case, anyway, we can see that this is stable. In fact, it's its solution set is exactly the same as the standard one, the usual plane waves and their superpositions. The way you'd see that this non-locality was present in the continuum theory would be the response to sources would be different. The thing I just have time to mention is that this suggests another way of doing renormalization of quantum field theory. This is in the continuum now, using the non-local analog of the D'Alembertian. The non-locality does not remove the infinities, as you might have expected. In fact, it seems to make them worse. But it does seem to allow one to introduce an invariant Lorentzian cutoff, which would be something new. And let me stop with asking, well, if there is this intermediate length scale lambda naught in which we start seeing non-locality, how big is it? Well, of course, we don't know at this point. The theory isn't giving us that. It tells us the microscopic scale should be about the Planck length. This other one was, so far as we proceeded, something we put in by hand. But we can set limits on it. Remember, if it's too small, the fluctuations get too big. If it's too large, then we've ruled it out observationally. So how small it can be? Well, some estimates of the fluctuations suggest that you'll start that it can be only as small as this, which is the microscopic scale times some macroscopic cutoff to the 1/3. It's natural to take the macroscopic cutoff to be the Hubble scale, and if you do that, you get actually nuclear size. So this wouldn't impact very much on propagation of light, whose wavelength is much longer than the nucleus, but it's pretty tantalizingly close to observation. So it may be that this residual non-locality might become accessible to observation in the near future if it isn't accessible already.